Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-last plot holes and gratuitous movies, it's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy.
Dana Gould is an accomplished writer, producer, podcaster, actor extraordinaire, and comedian who joined us back in December to discuss his illustrious career. However, he's back again to tell us about the upcoming third season of the show that he created, Stand Against Evil, and his new graphic novel, Planet of the Apes Visionaries, that's based on the original screenplay by Rod Serling, and of course involves Planet of the Apes. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Gould was kind enough to join us once again on Everything I Learned from Movies.
Hello.
How are you? Is the audio working?
Okay. Yep, checking it right now. If I could just get a 1, 2, 3 from you.
1, 2, 3, and the headphones are, the mic is working. That's what I'm checking.
Perfect.
All right, looks like we've got you.
Yep, we're good.
Okay,
on
good. All right, it's working. Good to see you guys again.
Likewise. Ah,
thank you. Thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, I like what I like.
Hey, he's not sick of us yet.
Yay!
How's the weather up there?
Very nice. It's a nice foggy day.
But that's the best time of year up there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, I love the fog and just kind of mellow. Very, very subtle and mellow.
Are you in the city or are you in East Bay?
We're in the East Bay. We're just outside of Berkeley in the Richmond Annex.
I know where you are. My old girlfriend was from Alameda.
Oh, yeah, excellent. Yeah. My partner in art is in Alameda.
All right, season 3, Stand Against Evil, coming up Halloween on IFC. How, what can we look forward to?
Well, it's funny. I think that the second year is better than the first year, and I think the third season really makes a leap from the second season. Just in terms of, you know, we set the mythology of the show is in stone, and we kind of did a lot of the big stories that we wanted to tell that you would tell. We did our American Werewolf in London parody, we did our Burnwich Burn parody, we did all that stuff. So by the third season, we really were able to push it a little bit, and our two craziest episodes are both in the third season. And by the end of the season, we really make a big leap in the mythology of the show. We really push past the mythology of the show by the end of the third season. So I was really, 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 really happy with how it came out.
Excellent.
It's fun. It gets crazy fun.
Or
most importantly.
I actually think most importantly, as I asked at Sketchfest, if it's not too big a spoiler, how many monkey-based realities are we going to run into?
Oddly, none.
Oh.
But we do for a show that takes place in a small New England town on a limited budget, we do have a Godzilla parody.
Sold.
Now see,
yeah,
I
we have a whole Kaiju episode. The Mothra twins are in it.
Yeah.
It's really something else.
Oh my gosh! So excited.
And I hear international star Eddie Pepitone may be making an appearance.
Yeah. Smooth skinned, almond eyed Eddie Pepitone makes an appearance in that episode. He is in that episode. Yeah. It's David Koechner and Eddie Pepitone are not playing the Mothra twins, but are in the
show. I was going to say.
Oh,
major spoiler
out.
Alert there. No.
You would think they would be. it's really great. And we have Mike Mendez, who is a director, directed Big Ass Spider and Don't Kill It and a lot of great movies.
Yeah.
He produced a movie I was in as an actor called Tales of Halloween.
Yeah. Excellent movie.
Great film.
And we were talking, and thanks. And he said that he had this idea for a short that he never made, and he pitched it to me. And I said, oh, you know, I'll buy that, and we can turn that into an episode of the show. And so Mike wrote it. He had to join the Writers Guild and wrote it. And it's sort of our version of Meet the Feebles. What's great about the show, and it's the whole point of the show originally, was that it's like a Trojan horse that allows me to parody all of these things that I like.
That's
there really should be. You'd think that there would have been an 8th episode so far. Yeah. I'm surprised there hasn't been.
There's always season 4. I mean, you know, fingers crossed.
We do have a joke, but that's it. We don't have an episode yet.
Yet.
Was it
beneath
the city of Miller's Grove or whatever?
It's close, yeah. You'll know when you see it. There's no doubt.
Excellent. Well, you mentioned David Koechner coming back, as well as Eddie Pepitone. Any other star cameos you can release? Or
Christopher Mintz-Plasse from Superbad. It started off as a Dark Shadows parody, and then became a Vampire Diaries parody, and ended up being a telenovela with vampires. And then Maria Bamford is in the show this year, and we have a lot of really funny people. I know I'm forgetting someone. And also Valerie Posse. We have a crossover episode, although we don't have a licensing. But for all intents and purposes, Mulder and Scully come to Willard's Mill and are pestered by a pesky reporter who wears a straw hat and a seersucker suit.
What? You just combined all my favorite things in the universe.
That's the second episode. That was the one where we really, I said, no, we're going to do this.
I know, it's X-Files EX hyphen files. It's completely different.
The X-Files. X-Files. That was the real fanboy geek out. And Rob Cohen, who directed the season, is an old writing partner and a very, very, very close friend of mine. I first met him when I crashed in his office at the Ben Stiller show, so we've worked together for a long time. And we did a show together on MTV in the 90s called Super Adventure Team, which was it was Team America, but before Team America. Who's better? But we were so geeked. We had written the Hex Files crossover with Jessica Conrad, who's a brilliant writer that's on the show. And then as we got it, I said we have to get Carl Kolchak in here. We've gotten this far. And no one's called those names. I mean, it's all legal. It's all done just within the shady gray nuance of legality. And it was we have to get Kolchak in there. So we restructured the episode, and then we were just cast the guy and get the wardrobe. It was just have you seen Kolchak? And when he came on the set, it was just it was spooky, because the guy was so perfect, and it was just seeing that character on the set was just oh my god, we're really doing this. This is great. Even more so than Mulder and Scully, because it's so iconic. That outfit is so iconic, and our crew is, it's all fanboys and fangirls, so they got it. We had the camera and the clunky tape recorder. We had everything, and it was just sweet. It was just really sweet.
Oh my gosh.
As I described, it's the show that likes what you like. That's all I can say. The show is as much of a fan of this stuff as you are. That's how I would put it.
Excellent. Season 4, when James Rockford comes to town and the show.
Angel.
Angel's got in some trouble, and he's got to get out of it.
I don't know if they've got I don't know if they've got the budget for a 70s Firebird, though.
we do blow up a car this season. We had a car in the first Koechner episode. We had a Camaro. We had a 70s Camaro. We,
yeah.
Whatever that Yeah, whatever. I'm not a car dude.
And you've rolled a couple of station wagons, so.
We blow up some station wagons. we absolutely blow up a car. And, you know, as you, when the opportunity presents itself, you'd be a fool not to take it.
Well, if we have an extra one, I mean.
We're in Rome.
I guess the licensing's a little looser in Georgia.
We're not blowing your car up because we have to. We're
It's because you want to.
Yeah.
Nice. And we also had the pleasure of speaking with John C. McGinley on Friday. Great guy.
Oh, you did? Oh, you talked to John.
Yeah, yeah. Great guy. You even busted my balls a little bit. It was great. How was it?
That goes without saying, by the way.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's an honor.
I was like, oh. How was it working with him? Like with him as the producer and he was the creator as well as, like, lead actor and so great supporting actor.
John's terrific because he is, as I've said many times, you know, Stan was originally based on my dad, and then John made it a different character because he's not what I wrote. I wrote a much older, more sedentary guy that just kind of would tag along and crab about what Evie was doing. It was a much smaller role. It was originally written. I assumed I was going to do it in prosthetics, and then the people at the network quite wisely said, "What if we had a star in the show?" and then it became a different character. It became a different show, and I think it became a better show. And John's really good, but he's really not playing. But he's not my dad. That character's not my dad. So the attitude is the same, but the physicality and the virility of it is not what I was thinking of. And it really became, and that's John's look on the show, it became, what if Quint had a daughter? Like, what if Quint was widowed? And, you know, he's Quint. It's like, yeah. You look at his facial hair, it's like, oh, that's Quint.
Yeah.
And so that changed, and then John and Stan and Evie became much more of a team. But John as a person he not only looks exactly like my older brother, he has the same personality as my older brother. So we have a very good rapport. Like, you know, I'm very I speak John, you know, and John speaks me, so it works really well. We have very little in common. He's a giant sports guy. I don't follow sports at all. He's really into working out and weightlifting. I don't, you know. I balk at lather, rinse. Repeat? Why repeat?
Why repeat? I did it right the first time.
Yeah. How dirty do you think my hair is? Wash twice. You're filthy.
Who is this for?
Homeless shampoo. that relationship turned out to be a really pleasant surprise. And we've become, obviously, you know, we've become friends, which is great.
Excellent.
And Janet, I've known forever and wrote Evie for Janet. I mean, Janet is the first four drafts of the script. Evie was just called Janet Varney.
I love it.
I had to come up with a name.
And then you had to hide it like Kolchak, so then it was Varney Janetson or something.
Yeah, Radash. The interesting thing, just the way the business works, I wrote it for Janet Varney, and I said in the meeting, like, well, Evie is Janet Varney. But what happens when you do that is that the network goes, well, let's, you know, they feel like that, you know, you're not letting them do their job. You know, our job is we put shows together and we cash those. So it's really a disservice to. I mean, I could literally walk in and go, well, Stan's Jack Nicholson, and he wants to do it, and they go, well, let us look at it. It's like, no, we'll tell you who Stan is.
Yeah.
because it's their money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And we all know what talks and what walks, and that's true. So Janet had to come in and audition to play the part of Janet Varney, and came in first and did it. And then we saw every other actress between the ages of 30 and 40 that lived in Los Angeles, California.
So like a dozen. Yeah.
They said, yeah, it's Janet. It's clearly Janet. And so she did win the part of Janet Varney.
Yay!
Yeah, it was, you know, at a certain point it was like, guys, it's her. look at it, it's her. But I get it. It's like when you go to a restaurant, it's like going to a restaurant and then the waiter tells you what you're eating.
Yeah.
Like even if it's what you want it to be your decision. So I do understand the thought process.
I believe it's called prefix menu. Yeah. John was telling us a story where he was auditioning for, even said in the description, a John McGinley type. And he's like, that's me. I'm John McGinley. And then I started thinking, but he's John C. McGinley. Is there like a John R. McGinley out there they specifically want? Or?
Yeah. Hi, let us see what you have. It's true. Yeah, it's true, though. It's a real pain in the ass.
Well, you had mentioned originally the character of Stan was supposed to be you in prosthetics. There's still time for Stan to meet his dad in the other world.
Hey.
Yeah, no, you could have, although if Stan ever met his dad, it would have to be Brian Dennehy.
True.
That would be the perfect person to play Stan. Would be Brian Dennehy. Although I do have somewhere the makeup test of me in prosthetics that I can email you. So.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that would be so good.
Yeah, awesome.
Maybe Kevin can meet his dad.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, that would be old Kevin would be. Kevin's going to go through a big change if we have a season 4.
Say future Kevin sent back through time?
Like a life change.
Okay.
We really do. At the end of the third season, you know, if the show was a book, the first three seasons would be the first three chapters, and it would be the end of part one. And the second chunk is absolutely part two. Things are different, things change. And I really learned that from being a Doctor Who fan about like how you never get really comfortable. The minute you get really familiar with something, they change it and challenge you, which I think is great. You can't push it too hard. Audiences need to feel familiarity and kinship with the characters, but it never gets to it never feels like it falls into being redundant. It always challenges itself to stay fresh. The other show that did that is Battlestar Galactica, the new one.
The new one, yeah.
Yeah.
Although now it's old.
the 10-year-old one, yeah.
you never felt like they were spinning their wheels.
Yeah.
That's how you keep that just like super dedicated fan base, though. I have absolutely dropped shows where it's like, well, we're three seasons in and this character has not even learned a lesson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, okay, I got it. Yeah, I got it. I have to say, I was a show I love, but I also think the X-Files is like, how many goofy ass pregnancies is this woman gonna endure?
Right. Yeah. True. Why? That's the one critique I have of it. Why is that the plot line they kept running with?
it's always.
Yeah.
Much of that show is a bunch of Blaine Anderson's womb.
Yeah, I also feel the same with Supernatural. It's like, how many times can you die and come back and go through hell and come back? And it's like,
I stopped watching Lost very early into Lost when it became apparent that they were making it up as they went.
Yeah.
What?
Season like, 2. Oh, okay, there's no reason, because I felt so burned. But you know, and then to prove that I am incapable of learning a lesson. I watched all 18 episodes of the new Twin Peaks, and everything was like, oh, really? Okay.
It'll wrap it up, yeah.
No, please.
Phil who? Never mind. Look at that balloon. Oh, yeah,
boom, boom, boom.
Like, I was sat on that couch, and I was like, you did it again.
You son of a bitch. You clever son of a bitch, again. You.
I remember walking out of the movie Lost Highway thinking, what did I ever do to him?
Yeah.
What did I ever do to him? And then he did it again. Please, I hope his last words in life is he just goes, suckers.
100%. You are now just every person who's ever seen a David Lynch movie. Yeah.
The owls are not what they seem.
You know, when there are people out there like, oh, we need season, whatever it is, season four, or season, yeah, season four. We said, why? What are you doing? Season four.
It's like, I got some post-its lying around. I can make a season out of that, I think.
Usually you can go buy on a pogo stick. There's nothing that you will need.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Old Bill Pullman in a Rocky J. Squirrel cap. All
right, I found this in makeup, but I found this guy wandering on the lot. Let's put him in.
Yeah. Well, somebody told me a story. So I know someone who knew Mark Frost. And this is secondhand. This is what my friend said Mark Frost told him. I knew we were in trouble when I saw the cream corn. A little kid is holding the cream corn in his hands, and it became Garmin Bosium. Yeah. And I said, well, I'm looking at the dailies, and I said, hey, David, what's with the cream corn? That wasn't in the script. And David Lynch said, well, we had it for lunch, and I thought it looked great. Okay, here we go.
Strap in, everybody.
I see.
And he's looking at listings for houses. Like, gonna have to downsize.
Now on a yacht. Yeah.
So, Mr. Gould, you want to tell us a little bit about Planet of the Apes Visionaries, which I have here in my hand, and it's amazing.
I'm glad you liked it. That was one of those things where I got an email from Daphna Pleven at Boom Comics out of the blue, she's like, we own the Planet of the Apes licensing from Fox, and we wanted to talk to you about it. And I was like, I originally thought they wanted me to like host an event or something, or moderate a panel. Like I thought it was like maybe they're doing a panel at Comic Con, they wanted to moderate it. Just I really didn't know what it was about. So I said, yeah, hey, how are you? And she said, like, are you familiar with the Rod Serling drafts? And I own them. I said, yeah, I have them both. They're great. She goes, well, we want to adapt them as a graphic novel, and we thought that you'd be the guy to do it. And it was like, we want to talk to you about maybe adapting it as a graphic novel and sign off right away. And I was immediately like, okay, be cool. Don't seem too eager, and they came, and I ended up getting the gig, and I did feel like I'd never written a graphic novel before, and I didn't know the format, and there was a lot about the process that I learned, and they were very patient with me, but I'm a giant Apes fan, obviously, and separate of Apes, I'm a giant Rod Serling fan. So I did feel that I could be, I was at least qualified to protect his work and not think it was about me. And so to that end, I always looked at the job as a, sort of like a caretaker. Like I'm going to take Rod Serling's script and I'm going to kind of pare it down and present it to me. And what was interesting about it, as somebody who knows the movie backwards and forwards, was in seeing Rod Serling's original draft, it's such a different story. I mean, it's the same scene. The scenes are the same. The structure of the piece is virtually identical, but it's told in a completely different way. The lead character is a much different character than Taylor. It's a guy named Thomas, and he's not the raging asshole Taylor is. He's actually quite affable and empathetic, which changes the story. And Because it takes place in a modern day city, and it's quite literally a mirror of our world. It's literally a mirror. The story, you don't get that crazy Tarzan feel. You don't have that action adventure stripe that made every 12-year-old boy go bananas, no pun intended, for this project. And that, it became apparent to me that it was a political thriller. It really played to me like 7 Days in May, the movie that Serling wrote about the military coup of the U.S. government. It came out after Manchurian Candidate. I think it's from about 65, John Frankenheimer directed. So it was really interesting just to see to tell the story in a very different way. Was really fun and really fascinating and so rewarding. And just to see my name and Rod Serling's name on the same piece of paper isn't something that I just doodled in a notebook. is insane. You know, that's just craziness.
Yeah, it's in people's homes.
Yeah, it's in people's homes. That is no business being real. That is no business being real.
It's so wonderful, and everybody needs to go over to DanaGould.com to get their autographed copy.
Yeah, go to DanaGould.com, and there's a link on my website that will put you to Boom Studios, which is where you can buy them. I'm not, like, out here shucking my own copy.
Oh, you don't just have a pile? There's not just a pile in the corner of your living room?
No, I do have a couple left.
The rest are in the trunk.
Oh, okay.
But I have one on my desk because I'm working on another project right now, another television project.
Ooh.
Just a pilot idea that I'm developing. And you know, every time you write something you go, "Oh, this is crap. Oh, no one's going to understand this. Oh, this is bullshit."
Mm-hmm.
And I will look at that book and go, "Now, crazier things have happened." Just keep going, you know. I always remember doing another thing about specifically with television. Like, you see the show Lucifer. Now, Lucifer was on like 2 years ago. I've never seen it.
Yeah.
But I do know that it's about the devil, and he's a cop.
Wait. It's about what now?
The devil comes to Earth.
No. Yeah.
With like a female partner, and I haven't seen it, but I'm like, if you can put that on the air, I can't come up with anything that I'm embarrassed about.
Yeah. So thanks for that.
You know, it's like I want to, you know, it's like you work on these ideas, and then you see like, what's the new show about? It takes place in a hospital.
Whoa, what?
Fresh ground. You know, it's like I wouldn't have the gall to go into a meeting and go, it's a bunch of doctors and there's a hospital.
Now,
you
know? Now wait, there's some drama.
Yeah, exactly. What if this one is called New Amsterdam or something? It's the same.
Oh my God.
And it's just like, I would not have the gall to pitch that. A renegade doctor who plays by his own rules. That's all I'm hoping.
I'm waiting like 3 episodes in, like House teleports into the hospital and he's like, what's going on here?
I can't go down that rabbit hole.
It's like Grey's Anatomy, but they're all kaiju.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah. I can dig it.
It's an emergency room staffed by otters.
Sold!
Wait, did we tell you about our graphic novel that we're working on?
Why not?
And it's also one of those things where it's like, I can see it as being like inspirational because like even Rod Serling got kicked off the Twilight Zone and stuff like that eventually.
Oh, yeah, you just have to keep pounding. And it's all about... So much of the business has nothing to do with what is on the page. It's really just, are you confident enough to sell it? Do you just have enough audacity to go in there? This is the greatest thing ever. Boom. And you have to be okay with, you know, it's like, I have a lot of friends that are writers that are infuriated. I'll give you an example. God rest his soul, Harlan Ellison. Harlan was always infuriated that the business wasn't a meritocracy. That it was the best people get the most stuff, and that's how it works. It's like, really? You're surprised that there's politics in this business. Like, it's like you're still waiting for the human behavior to be different. Man up.
But I mean, we're in a new millennium.
It's Joe. Business. It's a business.
Indeed.
Why did they make Planet of the Apes? Because they thought they could make money.
Oh, yeah.
And they did enough for, four sequels? Five sequels?
Yeah.
It's so funny. For lack of this, apropos of nothing, I was just watching, of all things, a documentary on the making of Batman Returns.
Yeah.
The
Dark, which is, again, my favorite Batman
movie. Oh.
R.C.
Yep, R.C.
Yeah.
It's like that in Dark Knight,
And by the way, one of the villains from that movie is now the president. That's another thing. At the time, Christopher Walken's character was based on Donald Trump. It was like, used as this rich builder. It's like literally one of the guys is the. But they talk about the first test screening of the movie in like Irvine. And they're like, it's just a bunch of kids and their parents, and when the lights came up, they looked like they'd been punched in the face.
It was like Dana Gould at the end of Lost Highway. What did I do to you?
The other story about when they showed the original first draft, the first cut of Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, literally at the end, parents were running out of the theater with their kids. Get them out of here.
See, if that had been my parents, they would have sat there and been like, nope, we paid for this, so we're staying. And they would have been like, this is why we don't pay for a movie.
I'm pulling that now. I don't pay for movies. Right. I did a show... It was me and Bobcat Goldthwait were doing stand-up, and one of the hosts of the show, I don't recall who it was, but he was talking about how only a dummy would pay to see a movie. You can get them all on BitTorrent. Is that a thing?
That's a thing.
Yeah, and he was like,
the only an idiot would pay for a movie. You can get it for free on BitTorrent. And then Bob went on and said, I have to say, I make my own movies, and I struggle for financing it. I just wanted to say whatever the guy's name is. He goes, that guy's an asshole. You know what happens if people don't make money on movies? Eventually there are no more movies.
Right? Yeah. They only do it for money. They're not doing it just because they like you.
Yeah, exactly. It was just that sense of entitlement. Shouldn't this very expensive art form be free for me?
Well, yeah, I mean, come on. Michael Bay does it, then I should see it for free, right?
Yeah, exactly.
He's got plenty of money.
I shouldn't have to pay.
Well, speaking of movies you'd pay to watch, we asked you what some of your favorite movies and stuff were, growing up, getting into the business and stuff, and the one you really want to talk about was American Werewolf in London.
Although I can, specifically because I can no longer talk about Planet of the Apes. there are certain movies that just resonate with you so strongly. And for me, it's obviously Planet of the Apes, Ed Wood, and Plan 9 both are incredibly important to me. I would take both of them to a desert island. American Werewolf in London is also one of those films. And then the fifth, I would probably say the Night Stalker TV movie.
Yeah.
Other movies are just like, they're not the greatest movies of all time, but they're the ones that I hold very near and dear. And American Werewolf in London was one of the first times I saw it. I was in 11th grade when it came out. I was an usher at the movie theater, so I saw it for free. I just walked in. And I remember really specifically, it was the night before my PSATs. I don't remember that year. Your pre-SATs?
Yeah.
It was me and a couple of my friends went the night before our PSATs. But I was like, right out of the gate watching it, I was like, oh, this was made just for me. I think it starts with Bobby Vinton singing Blue Moon.
Yeah.
And I was like, they didn't start it with scary music. They started it with like something incongruous. And I was only 15 or 16 at the time, but I was like, wow, I get this. I totally get what they're doing. And the fact that the guys were funny but funny in a natural, like, they knew that they could be funny and scary in the same thing, which I've always said, like, that would be the one thing I would love to do, is do a thing where it's scary and then funny and then funny and then scary. And finally, it took me a long enough time, but I finally did it. And just watching the movie, and just every frame of that, it's like Matt Weinhold, who does the podcast Monster Party, we were talking about some terrible kaiju film, and he said that every frame of that movie is a love letter to me. And that's how I felt about American Werewolf in London. Like, yeah, this is absolute. This movie gets me 100%. It's not only scary, it's funny. It's scary in a smart way. It's funny in a smart way, and it knows that it is a horror movie that loves horror movies. You know, they talk about other horror movies in this horror movie, which is great. And I stole that tone, lock, stock, and barrel for Stand Against Evil, you know.
And you should spread it around.
Yeah. Stan has a long monologue in the third season about how great Ingrid Pitt is. There's no way you would know who Ingrid Pitt is, but I didn't care. Stan is a vault of very weird, specific information.
That's what makes him so good.
It was the fact that they were referencing. Did you ever see The Wolfman? The one with Oliver Reed? No, the other one. Like, the fact that they said that in a movie, that they were talking about movies in a movie, was crazy. Nobody talks about movies in movies. And it was the first time I'd ever seen that done. And it was like, can they do that? Is that possible? So, it was like at the beginning of Pulp Fiction when they were talking about how a TV pilot is made.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Wait, this Fox Force 5, when's this coming out? I gotta see this.
it was so terrific. Also, because what I love about it, like John Carpenter's The Thing, which is up there for me, the effects are all practical, so they still look amazing. It's not like the first 15 years of CGI where it looks, now it's hard to watch. Like, your eye knows, it's the reason the effects in Stand Against Evil are practical. Your eye knows what's real and what's not. And once you leave reality, it becomes harder to do humor, because humor is... The reality is the straight man for humor. And if you have redefined reality, you have no straight man. And that's why movies like Ivan Reitman's Evolution don't work.
What are you talking about?
Stuff that your eye is telling you isn't real. So why am I laughing at the way this guy behaves? He doesn't live in reality. I'm sorry if I touched on a sore spot.
No, sorry. We did Evolution on this here podcast, and I was the one who defended it, just because that movie does not work, and I think that's one of the reasons.
It's also Ghostbusters 3.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. There was a script for Ghostbusters 3, and then Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray didn't want to do it, and they just basically put different actors in the roles and didn't call them Ghostbusters.
See, that's the thing. I think I just really...
Like Orlando Jones is Bernie Hudson. David Duchovny is Bill Murray. And then, you know, it's like, right out of the gate, there's your problem. We don't have Bill Murray. We have David Duchovny. David Duchovny's great. But if you don't have Bill Murray, you don't have Bill Murray.
So, right?
We don't have King Kong, but we do have... I'm not interested. You don't have King Kong.
See, I think that's one of the things I do like about that movie, though, is that David Duchovny and Orlando Jones, they don't go together. They're peanut butter and mayonnaise. And then the rest of this movie is also more peanut butter and mayonnaise. And so it's just kind of like watching like a train wreck, but like that hasn't stopped burning yet.
To that end, Ghostbusters should not work, but it does work.
But it's perfect.
I don't know how. Well, it hasn't worked because you point a camera at Bill Murray and it works.
And Harold Ramis is an amazing writer.
Ghostbusters, there are a couple of movies like that because I'm always talking about this because everything I do is a hybrid. The show I'm coming up with now is a hybrid. And it's always, you know, Ghostbusters, is it on paper it shouldn't work, but it does work. And it works because of Bill Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And Beetlejuice shouldn't work because it, but it does work because of Michael Keaton and Tim Burton when he was trying.
Yeah. Oh, it's one of my favorite movies of all time, Big Trouble in Little China. Should not work, but it does.
Work. God damn it, it does. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. But those are the exceptions that that prove the rule in my book.
But so back to American Werewolf in London. It's funny, my experience watching it was very similar to yours, but later, when I was a kid, all I wanted in life was a dog. We could not get a dog. I asked for a dog, and my parents got me a goat. But could not have a dog. I was upset.
I've never heard that.
Yes. We couldn't have a dog, but we could have two goats.
That's insane. And where did you live?
A little tiny town outside of Sacramento, California.
What's it called?
It's called Orangevale. I wanted a dog. All I would draw were dogs and wolves. And I can't remember if it was AMC or TMC, but every October used to do a thing where they would marathon horror movies, and they would do them all in a row. They'd do all the vampire movies in a row, and they would do all the werewolf movies in a row, and they'd do all the witch movies in a row. And it was one of my favorites, and I was just, like, binge watching all the werewolf movies because they were guys who turned into dogs, so like, why not? This is the greatest thing in the world. And my dad was like, oh, you haven't seen the best werewolf movie yet, American Werewolf in London.
Uh-huh.
I have that on Betamax I taped off of Showtime. And he dug in the Betamax box and we pulled it out. We played it because he still to this day has his Betamax player because he's still convinced it's the best format. We also had the Laserdisc, but that's another story.
Wow. Good for you.
But yeah, I watched that movie and I had that same thing. My sister was just like, oh, this is stupid. And I'm just like, no, this is great. My dad's right. This is the greatest werewolf movie.
That's so cool that your dad was into that.
Well, my dad was into weird, obscure films. Like, he did a little bit of special effects work blowing cars up in that, like, in the early 60s, late 70s in San Francisco. He worked for a junkyard that would supply cars. And to blow up, and like he helped.
He worked for a junkyard and he loved horror movies. They're the coolest in the world.
He also toured with Uriah Heep and Buddy Miles, but he's lived an interesting life. But I just like it instantly became one of my favorite movies. And when I wore the Betamax out, he went ahead and got it for me on VHS because he found it at Costco.
God bless him.
As for me, I watched American Werewolf in Paris first because it was I was a teenager when it came out, and so everybody's like,
"Godfather 3 before you watch the Godfather 2.
Exactly, and so then someone's like, "Oh, you need to watch the original." And I'm like, "I'm good."
When I first saw the Phantom Menace.
Yeah, one of those guys, unfortunately. But I watched it non-TV edit, all that, for the first time, what, about a year and a half ago?
Yes, he was like,
fantastic.
Oh, I've seen that movie, but this sweet man grew up in Utah and watched the Utah TV edit of American Werewolf in London. So he had not seen
it.
Yeah, a couple of guys went to a bar, got lost, he woke up in a hospital for some reason, nobody knows why, his face looks like a vampire for about 5 seconds. It's like 45 minutes. It's not the best.
Yeah, television
edits of an American
film. Did you have, like, a local horror movie host?
Real scary movie. But not too scary. Unfortunately not.
Terrifying movie, The Boy Who Drank Soda.
It was caffeinated. Oh, God.
Yeah.
He also watched...
I can't even imagine that.
Oh, worse than that, he had only seen the Utah TV edit of Blazing Saddles until about a year ago as well.
Yeah. Oh my god, again, I can't even imagine that.
Oh, we got 3 minutes into the movie and he looked at me, he's like, I have not seen this movie.
Not even a little bit.
That's so funny.
All I knew was there was a dance number in it somewhere and that was it. Everything else was like...
And that they ate beans and farted.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, in the fart.
Count Basie was in the desert, that's all I know.
But yeah, American Werewolf in London, absolutely spectacular, and like every scene holds up, and I've shown it to people and they go, oh, it's so dated, and I'm like, it's period piece, shut up.
I don't even see how is it dated outside of just, I guess, clothes and stuff.
I think
I think that incredible porn theater they go into is a little dated.
I guess they don't have those anymore.
Yeah, and honestly, I really want to see the rest of that porn. I'm kind of gripped by the story, what's going on there, the pathos behind it.
See you next Wednesday.
Yeah, yes.
I'm sorry, you have the wrong number.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, but again, like, not only... What was like it also, especially like when I saw I was 15, 16 years old, you know, if Jenny Agutter in that movie is like every little white boy's dream.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, I was never into like the she was gorgeous, but also like gorgeous in an almost attainable way. It wasn't like, you know, the super blonde, you know, yeah. Whatever. It was like it'd be nice to go to the moon too. This could almost happen.
Yeah, she's girl next door pretty. Like, as a, like, 12-year-old, I don't think I was, like, must have been, like, 8 when my dad pulled that out, because appropriate, you know, children's movie. Yeah, it was just one of those things where it's like, oh, there's hope for this chubby little brunette. I might be able to grow up and go for a walk.
Yeah, exactly. I'm looking online to get the name. Like, the analogy was, she wasn't Lonnie Anderson from WKRP. She was Bailey Quarters.
There
we go. She was the brunette in the class. Like, yes, this could happen. I could do this.
That's the one I might be able to meet in a bar.
Yeah, exactly. That was her. Her name was Jan Smithers, and she played Bailey Quarters on WKRP. It was like, yeah, she looks like a person.
And they're talking about doing the reboot with Max Landis kind of taking over as writer and director. Are you...
Well, at least they're keeping it in the family.
Yeah, yeah. are you hesitant about that? I don't know.
I didn't know they were planning on rebooting it, but it's not the, you know, there are ways, I mean, Max is incredibly talented, and there are ways to do it and keep it interesting. I think the thing to do is not try to remake it. To come up with a different story that takes advantage of the modern world, and, you know, to make it relevant to today.
Yeah, like keep it in the universe, but just like make it its own story.
Yeah.
I just had a thought. Mm-hmm. Since you did Chronicle the found footage thing, do you think that'll?
Oh, found footage werewolf movie.
Found footage practical effects.
I would like to follow this is sort of the Howling, like the werewolves from Things We Do in the Shadows, because werewolves, would they come together? Would they, you know, would there be a support group for people that were like, they were werewolves, but they didn't want to kill people, and so like, all right, when it's a full moon, we have people that will come and make sure that we're locked up. Like, there are stories to tell.
Yeah, hey, they're pack animals. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and that's just it. In the movies, it's always the lone one, and everybody knows, like, the lone animal is the one that's the most dangerous. Maybe when they're in packs, they're just fine.
they're just preoccupied.
Yeah, they're busy, like, figuring out the social structure. They're too busy to kill people.
Ooh,
tearing up the garbage.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, all right, guys, full moon tonight. You know what that means. We get really drunk, like so drunk, we'll turn and we'll just nap through it.
I mean, usually, like, when they become so drunk that they became incapacitated, so when they were werewolves, they just couldn't get out of the building. There's a lot of things that you can, you know, there's a lot of ways you can go with it. I mean, that's a beautiful thing about werewolves, and it lends itself to a lot of different types of stories. Like, yeah, people would exploit it. You know, it can tell a story about addiction. It can tell a story about, you know, bureaucracy. It can tell mm-hmm. a story about the militarization of the police department. Like, whatever you want to yeah. use werewolves as a stalking horse to get through that. You know, I think that's one of the best things about it. I didn't know that was happening. Is that, like, a current thing?
Yeah, it's something, like, it's on IMDb. It's been kind of rumored for, like, a year, and it was kind of, like, when John Landis died, everybody was kind of like, oh, man, I love American Werewolf in London. It should totally reboot it. And then it's like...
He didn't die. John didn't die.
Or what? Maybe it was Rick Baker. It's all on the internet. It's all on the internet. What can I say?
No, John's not dead. John's a friend of mine. I wouldn't know.
Yeah. Damn you, internet.
See, you can go straight to the source and find out if these are just internet rumors or if this is real.
Yeah. No, John's around.
Yes. Okay, let's get him on the phone right now. Let's figure this all out.
You can interview him. Yeah, you can fix that. He just produced a movie called I Hate Kids. It just came out.
Yes.
I mean, title yeah. tells me.
Yeah. I mean, it's no yeah. kids today need to know these facts.
And it stars the lead of an American Werewolf in Paris, oddly enough.
Oh, Tom Everett Scott?
Right, yeah, it stars Tom Everett Scott, but he pulls it against him. God bless him.
Nice, yeah, yeah. I say when you were talking about, like, that you can tell what CGI from, you know, 15 years ago and stuff, like,
oh, it's so
it instantly
awful.
Pops
it's so
in.
Awful. It's so awful when you see it now. It's just like, there's a flatness and a,
Yeah.
It's super bad. Super bad.
Yeah, that's why I like watching the original. I was like, oh, this is 10 times better. How could I screw that? It like Blues Brothers and Blues Brothers 2000, in a way.
Yeah. Oh, another Blues Brothers 2000 reference. Yeah.
So,
what are you going to do?
Yeah. So you mentioned you have other projects going on. Any others you can share with? I know with the pilot, it's kind of still in the works.
No, the pilot is just in the there's a movie I'm finishing work on what would be a big movie. We can't announce it until it's greenlit. But I actually think it's going to get greenlit. It's a sequel to a very popular movie that hasn't had a sequel in a long time. It's like, we're going to make another one. And I'm working with the original writer. And when this, if it gets announced, I think it's going to get announced, and we can talk about it. If not, nope. And I'm working on another television show that hopefully will sell. And then, if Stand Against Evil gets picked up for a fourth season, I'll do that. And if this one gets picked up, I'll do both. And if one or the other, but, you know, I like to stay busy. I like to keep going, and my podcast is still chugging along.
Yes.
Never an hour.
Yes. Fantastic. And you got the Halloween episode coming up soon.
September, which is still coming out, and then I'll get Halloween right a little bit after that.
Whoa.
September's is cutting it now, and then I'll have the Halloween one.
Is this the first time we get a September and an October episode?
Well, no, it'll be usually they come out at the end of the month, so the Halloween one will come out earlier. But I do have I interviewed Wayne Kramer from MC5 and Matt Bronger about his new podcast called Advice from a Dipshit, and that's coming out in about a week to 10 days, and then Halloween will come out in the right around the middle of October.
Awesome.
Get a little bit of a bonus. Halloween's always ginormous.
Oh, yeah. I think I still have the 3.5-hour one from last year, and it just listened to it over again. I think Mike Mendez was on it, like you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, he
might
be on it again.
Yeah. Always good, always good.
Yeah. I don't know who's on it. I have ideas of, I know who I want on it. I have to see if it's schedule's working.
Knock on wood, I hope
I promise you I'll get somebody.
I'm not going to lie, I think I could handle like 3 hours of Dana Gould and Eddie Pepitone just talking about horror movies.
3 hours of me and Eddie Pepitone talking about avocados would be interesting.
You guys have such good chemistry together, I love it.
Yeah, he's a true improviser in the sense, like, he goes after everything. He leaves nothing, he leaves no meat on the bone. You know,
nice.
He dives in full force every done.
Excellent. And do you have a tour dates coming up? I know you're coming to San Francisco in December. But
I am coming to San Francisco in December. I'm going to be in my friends in Massachusetts. I will be at the Norwood Theater on October 5th. And then in November, I'm going to be, hang on, let me just look, since I'm schlepping away here. In November, I'm going to be in Atlanta at the Laughing Skull on November 8th, 9th, and 10th. And I will be in Minneapolis at the Acme Comedy Company November 15th, 16th, and 17th. And then I will be in Philadelphia at the Funny Bone the 29th, 30th, and the 1st of December. And then I go to the Punchline after that.
Yeah,
yeah, we'll be there.
When is the Punchline?
I think it's December 9th. And
it's usually second week of December.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, I've got all that.
Excellent.
Oh, and of course, again, season 3, Stand Against Evil, coming out on Halloween on IFC. Yes, it's a channel.
That's right. We're very excited.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks. Thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. And I hope to see you. Let me know when this goes up, and I'll plug it, and I will see you in December, I hope.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, we should.
Mr. Gould, can I just ask one favor real quick?
Yeah, sure. Of course.
Can I get a hi, I'm Dana Gould, and you're listening to Everything I Learned from Movies? Everything I Learned from Movies.
Okay, great. Sure, I'll do it right now.
All right.
Hi, this is Dana Gould, and you're listening to Everything I Learned from Movies on your radio or computer. Let me do that again.
Okay.
Hi, this is Dana Gould, and you're listening to Everything I Learned from Movies on your radio, phone, computer, television, or record player.
Thank you so much! Oh my god!
Fantastic. Thank you, sir.
I will touch you guys soon. Okay, good. Well, I don't know your dad, but I do know that John Landis is alive, so we've...
Yeah,
yeah, all right.
Thank you for clearing that up.
Ooh. Excellent. That's two, like, thumbs up in a row.
Super cool. All right, well, I will speak with you guys soon.
And you had mentioned, as I've mentioned before, if there's anything in my shop, Steve will send you the link. I do the art stuff. If you want, just message Steve what you want, and I can send it to you. If the girls want anything, have a little shopping spree on us.
That would be great. Yeah, no, I have you're my faves.
Aw, thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Okay, yeah, I'm off to work. I'll talk to you guys later.
All right, bye. Thank you. Have a good one, sir.
Bye.
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 Oh my god, Steve Tentacle, that's my spirit animal.
he's an American treasure. So that was Dana Gould.
John Landis is still alive.
John Landis is still alive. Steve apparently misread something, or maybe it was him retiring or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think somebody on that crew passed away in that.
Yeah, like Rick Baker or something. Yeah.
We'll have to Google it. See, as you can tell, no studying.
That's right. Exactly.
We had it confirmed once again that Evolution is not a good movie.
Well, I'm glad I got some celebrity gravitas behind my argument. But,
I agree, that's not a good movie, but I still enjoy it. I'm the person who's still buying it on Amazon.
But yeah, of course. If you like this and more interviews, we got plenty of them. We're on Patreon. We're on Twitter, Facebook, all that fun stuff
at
EILF Movies. That's Everything I Learned from Movies. And our main website is EILFM.podbean.com.
Yeah.
All the podcatchers. My lovely wife makes art.
I do, yes. If you need some super cute enamel pins, is this coming out before Halloween? For Halloween, I have these super adorable black cat pins where the cat's body is purple glitter, so I guess it's not really a black cat, but it's got all the moon phases that glow in the dark. It's only $12 or 2 for $20 at untidyvenus.etsy.com. That's a goddess who's bad at housekeeping.etsy.com.
Yeah, so until next time, I'm Steve.
And I am completely overwhelmed.
And this is Everything I Learned from Movies. Have a good night, everybody.
Rod Serling, Planet of the Apes, Dana Gould, like, oh, my worlds are exploding, and oh my god, Steve. Oh my god, this is everything I love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
And get that autographed copy now, huh?
I have an unautographed copy so that I can actually, like, touch it. I need an autographed one so I can, like, frame it.
Yeah, we'll take it in December when we see him.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Shit, are we still recording? Have a good night, everybody.
Night, everybody.
Hi, this is Dana Gould, and you're listening to Everything I Learned from Movies on your radio, phone, computer, television, or record player.